So anyway, for the talk, just to warm people up, one of the good friends, disciples, followers from Canada, I'm sure, is listening. If you're not listening now, we'll get hold of the talk later on. They're very, very devoted disciples. Very wonderful people, too. But they asked me that they've been trying to encourage some of their friends to do some meditation. But then some of the friends equate meditation to mindfulness practice. And sometimes you see that people who practice mindfulness, that sometimes they get into difficulties and problems. And sometimes it's just like people who have COVID-19 vaccine. Sometimes they have problems, and it's a tiny, tiny sort of proportion. I think somebody said it's got more chance of having a problem with a COVID vaccine. The chances of that are just more remote than winning the lotto. It's just like people surfing. Some people who surf on Western Australia get eaten by sharks. But it doesn't really stop people surfing. But even with mindfulness practice, sometimes there's some problems there. And you know, there doesn't need to be. It's much safer than surfing, but it's also much more healthy. And one of the reasons why any problems exist in the first place is that this thing called mindfulness has been just almost like titrated, taken away from its context in other forms of Buddhist practice. And when it's by itself, it misses out on some of the wonderful safeguards which are always there. And to make a point, you know that when I first went to teach meditation overseas, I think it was over in Malaysia. People say, oh, Malaysia's a Muslim country. There's a lot of Buddhists over in Malaysia as well. And over there, they were very keen on doing all the parts of Buddhism, especially meditation practice. And when I talked to them, I was stunned, I was surprised, because they were complaining that meditation gave you samadhi headache. They call samadhi means like, well, it actually meant over there concentration, it really means stillness, meditation headache. I couldn't understand that. I've been meditating for years by that time. How many years? Oh, crikey, about 30 years probably. I never had a headache when meditating. Actually, I use meditation to overcome headaches. I use meditation to overcome headaches, indigestion, scrub typhus fever. That's a pretty big one. And all these other stuff, even like injuries, like bruises and stuff, if we fell over. And it's amazing. I thought, meditation is there to help your health, not to create more headaches and problems. What on earth have you been doing? And of course, it was the meditation which was being done. It had a lot of problems if you compared it with traditional Buddhist meditation. The meditators there were struggling and striving and trying to get something. And you find whenever you want something, try to get something and strive something. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make sure it works. I'm going to be my own story. I'm still a layperson. We started doing some meditation. And it was the Waisak time. This was celebrating the birth, enlightenment, passing away of the Buddha. And when I heard the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, what I heard was that Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and he made a resolution, a determination. I'm going to get enlightened right here. I'm not going to move. Even if my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I'm not going to move from this seat until I get full enlightenment. Being stupid at the time, I thought that was really cool. So you know what I did? I went back to my room. I put a little couple of cushions out. Stupid young man. I was about 18 at the time. You know, 18-year-old men. Any 18-year-old men here? Don't admit it. Don't admit it. Come on, you're not 18. You're much older than that. I said 18, not 80. So I sat down on that cushion. I made a resolution. I'm as good as a Buddha. I was in India. He didn't have an education. I thought like that, really arrogant. And my, you know, my maximum amount of time I could meditate for at 18 was about 20 minutes. And that was pushing it. 25 sometimes on a good meditation. So I sat down and said, forget about all of that. I'm not going to move. Now I've got to get enlightened. I want to get it out of the way. I've got many other things to do in my life. I sat there and made the resolution, I'm not going to move until I get perfect enlightenment. Or, you always got to have an alternative, or my blood dries up and bones turn to dust. I actually made that resolution, honestly, I did. It was hell. After half an hour, I managed to get to half an hour, my bones were just, they were burning in pain, my back was aching, every muscle was on fire. No, I'm not enlightened yet, carry on. You know, I got to about between 35 and 40 minutes. I couldn't stand it any longer. And I opened my eyes, and you know, I wasn't enlightened. And my blood hadn't dried up yet, my bones hadn't turned to dust. I was really stupid. But later on, instead of just running because of arrogance, and meditating just because I thought I was so good, I had a marvelous teacher like Ajahn Chah. And he kept on saying, not just once, but many, 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 many times, probably 1,000 times in the 9 years which I meditated with him. He said, you meditate to let go of things, not to gain things. And I didn't understand a word of it when I first heard it. But I realized that was some of the most wonderful advice he could ever give. You want to get something, something you want to aim for, to strive for, you get very tense. But if you want to let go of things, you get lighter and lighter, and the path becomes so easy and peaceful. And that becomes another reason why many people, if they don't understand what meditation or mindfulness is, they want to get something, there'll always be the tension, the tightness there. And a lot of times you can't get what you think you want or you think you need. You don't need very much, but never think we think we need this. And when you're fighting, you'd always get injuries, what sometimes they call collateral damage. And actually what happens when people just are mindful. So as soldiers, they can shoot more accurately and kill people. When they're mindful, so they can win more arguments in debates. When they're mindful, so they can make more money on the stock market or whatever. If it's trying to get something, you'll find that's not really Buddhist meditation. It's not mindfulness. When it's trying to let go of things, to simplify your life, to make your life more peaceful, more at ease. We always know in spiritual life, you keep on saying, how much do you really need? To be healthy, to be happy, to have a wonderful life, how much do you really need? If you want to know, next time you go to Bodhinyana Monastery, go and ask to have a visit to my home, where I live. Hands up now, how many of you have actually been into my cave? Oh, I've got to put my hand up as well, because I've got to be honest, I've been in there. Is it big? It's big in peace. It's big in freedom. It's a tiny little cave. And that's all I need. I've got a toilet around the back. But it's about 3 meters. It's like a dome. 3 meters diameter. And that semi-dome. And in that cave, I've got a bed, meditation cushion, a blanket, and water, a flashlight, and a clock. A little Buddha statue, and I do have, I must admit, electricity. That's just to light the way. And a cork floor. That's it. You know, it's really easy to clean. It doesn't take that long. But it's also the simplicity of it. What do you need? So a lot of times, even in life, when we simplify things, we find that, you know, life is much more peaceful. And even in meditation, if you want to get things, then there's no end of getting more things. How many more things do you want? How rich do you want to be? If you ever notice really rich people, they always have to keep on working. You know, Elon Musk, he's got enough money now, he should be able to retire. He has to work. So how much money would you want? Apparently that somebody won the lottery on Friday. Anyone here? If it was you, now being that wealthy is just really a burden. It causes you so much suffering. I remember, I don't mind saying, meeting this guy. He was the CEO of Tropicana Resort and lots of other businesses over in Malaysia. And he invited me to his house. I can't say a house, his mansion. Huge thing. But what really really struck me, that going into his residence, there were two guards with machine guns at the gate. It's like going into Buckingham Palace, where they have the household guards. And so, why do you need guards with machine guns? I've got no guards with machine guns in front of my cave. It's because there's a lot of fear when you have many things. If you only have few things or old things, you don't have to be afraid at all. I learned that from my father, strange enough, because where he lived was in a very small council flat in London, like government-sponsored housing for the poor. We had a very happy time there. But often I just asked him, why don't we lock the door when we go out? I said, aren't you afraid of burglars? Then my father said, no, I'm not afraid of burglars. In fact, I'm quite hopeful a burglar might come in, take pity on us and leave us something. So at least you didn't have to worry about anything. Not worrying about anything. Great peace and happiness, contentment. So that's also one of the reasons when you're not worrying about attaining things or losing, attaining, getting things, but you're more happy with emptying out your mind. Then actually you're meditating in a proper way. And where that comes from, if anybody wants to check me out, that comes from the second factor of the Eightfold Path. Meditation is a whole path, Eightfold Path. Meditation, the deep meditations are the last factor. Mindfulness is the seventh factor. The second factor is of the right ways of what we call right motivation. And Ajahn Brahmani keeps calling it intention, but I prefer motivation, where you're coming from. Not what you're trying to achieve. Because the right motivations, there are three right motivations for meditation. If you do your mindfulness practice with these three motivations, you're really safe. The first motivation is called nekama. It's a Pali word, it means letting go, renunciation, giving up, simplifying. And you know, that's really Buddhist. They were supposed to live simple lives. Very few people live simple lives these days. But we really try as best we can as monks, you know, and nuns, to live simple as we possibly can. It's really strange, isn't it, that, you know, sometimes I used to go overseas, and sometimes, you know what would happen? People would buy you business class tickets. Honestly, they did. I did this, what was it called? A keynote address at conferences. I used to go to conferences. A keynote address at the 2018, I think it was, World Computer Conference in Daejeon, South Korea. That was a really good gig. The World Computer Conference. And I'm not just giving a small talk, giving a keynote address. That's after all these politicians and dignitaries and stuff gave, and then I had to set the tone of the conference. And I did really well. You know, that's what they offered this business class ticket on Singapore Airlines all the way to South Korea and back, a nice hotel. And they gave $2,000 to the Buddhist Society just for a quarter of an hour's talk. So what we call a nice little earner of our PSWA. But then, you know, you go on business class and they ask you, how much do you earn? Nothing. How much money have you got? Zero. What's a poor person doing traveling on business class? No money in the bag anywhere. So I like those like contradictions in life. And what is a person who I don't know much about computers, do I? Yeah, I don't know much. When anything goes wrong, you have to ask somebody else. So, hey, what's gone wrong? What are you doing? Doing the keynote address in front of all these computer wizards. They asked me that. And I gave the answer that, you know, in life, you don't have to know very much to innovate. In fact, the more you know, the less you see. And you're trained always to see things in the same way. It's a narrow course of mind. And as a monk, you can actually do all sorts of weird stuff, like meditate and see things in a different way. To innovate means being still, letting everything go and seeing things afresh. And of course, we all know in economies, innovation is the key to success. Not doing things in the same old way, but doing things in a different way. And look at this place. I mean, Buddhist Society of West Australia. As far as I know, it's one of the biggest Buddhist societies in the world. It's because this is how we practice. Innovation, doing things differently. But anyway, back to mindfulness. When we learn how to let go of things, and the other thing in right motivation is like letting go, and then the second factor of right motivation is like kindness, compassion. And that was something, I often say this to people, that was something I thought was obvious. If ever you read the life story of the monks and the nuns in the time of the Buddha, compassion was really important. Being kind to all beings. You know, there's this one lady, I think, she actually didn't say where she was from. You know, there's still a lot of people who have discriminatory minds. She was a Buddhist, but she said, something happened the last week. Said her son came out and said he was gay. Ajahn Boa, what should I do? Because there are some societies where that's still regarded as terrible. And I said, look, you probably chant this every day as a Buddhist. May all beings be happy and well. I think you chanted that here, just before I came in. gay people, lesbians, transgenders, LGBTQIA+. Aren't they beings? So they deserve kindness, compassion, empathy, just like everybody else. What's the problem? And the fact that she didn't realize she'd be chanting, and part of the chant, may all beings be happy and well. Even Donald Trump, Mr. Putin, who else is in the black books? May they all be happy and well, come on. Because there's something powerful which I saw in that type of Buddhism. When you give happiness to your enemies, then your enemies are not your enemies anymore. It's weird, but they become soft and peaceful. And where this comes up, I wanted to bring this up, was, you know, sometimes when, I think this BBC article I read a long time ago, it said one of the problems with mindfulness, they get you to actually just allow things to be. That's not good enough. Because sometimes what comes up is some of the past traumas which people have. And those past traumas, if it's just being aware of them, you can't hold them, you can't handle them. They're just really painful. And that's where a lot of times people just have almost psychoses with this mindfulness practice. But what's the difference between how we do things in Buddhist mindfulness practice? If something comes up from the past and it's really a bad memory, very awful memory, difficult memory, something very hard for you to hold, how can we let go of that past? With kindness. It's a strange thing to say, but I've said this so many times before, if you're meditating and you know your mind just wanders off to the past because something really hard happened to you, or a repressed memory comes up into your mind and it's a painful memory, what do you do with it? And if you try and get rid of it, you give it anger, ill will, you don't want to face it, it often gets much worse. So there's something else you can do with it, was give it kindness. Give you yourself kindness, whoever did that to you, kindness. And here we go again with this simile. It's such a beautiful simile. The last time I gave it on the retreat, which I did after Easter, I remember after doing this simile, just everyone was looking at me, just blown away, even though they heard it before. Many actually were teary afterwards. Because it was that simile of that group here in Perth called ASSETS, Australian Society, Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And one day, they invited me to go and visit their centre, do a blessing or something. I said, yeah, sure. Because many of them actually came here. And I didn't know why. Why did you invite me? And they said because a couple of their key strategies they learnt here. Which ones? And when they told me, oh, it's an emotional, deep, right inside me, really high, made me incredibly happy. That's why I love telling that story. They said the one story which worked the best was kindness. What do you mean kindness? It's that old story of to telling, well, my father told me. My father features a lot in this talk this evening. My father used to tell me, just, son, wherever you go, whatever you do, however you turn out in your life, he said to me when I was about 14-year-old, and I was still uncertain in life, he said, whatever you do, the door of my house will always be open to you. And of course his house was a council flat with hardly anything in it. But you know that sometimes somebody says something, maybe here, maybe a friend, maybe something you read or hear. It's so you know this is important. And I remember that as a 14-year-old boy, that this is important. I don't know why, I can't understand it. Because you know, a boy's emotions are not very developed. But I remembered it enough that when I became a monk, and one of the nice things about being a monk or a nun, you have time. You have time to really figure out your emotional world and what it means. And that was one of the unfinished business I had with my father. He died when I was about 16. What did he really mean by that? And of course, you've heard me say this before, it became the title of my first book. What he meant was not his house, he meant his heart. He said, whatever you do, however you turn out, whatever happens to you, the door of my heart will always be open to you. When I realized that was his meaning, that hit me so deeply. It was the first expression of unconditional love that I could really understand. And it made so much sense to me. And of course, a father to his son was, you know, so powerful. I wish I'd understood that when he said it to me, how powerful it was. And of course, that story, which, you know, even here I can see you're looking at me, and it's meant something to you already. That meant something to a couple of psychologists, psychiatrists who would come here and then work with people who had been very badly abused overseas. And people who had survived somehow. When I heard some of their statements, I don't know how they could survive some of that abuse, physical, emotional, in some of these regimes overseas. But anyway, they'd made it to Australia, physically safe, emotionally, still in the torture chambers, still being raped, beaten, for no reason. I've had a very simple life, so I can't really just understand just how they must have felt and just how they survived is beyond me. But now they're here, they're still carrying that huge burden. And how they overcame that burden, and that's just, you know, because I developed that story and taught it, that gives me so much joy. How they overcame that was they decided to incorporate that as one of their strategies. But when a person feels safe, you can't force anything. You can't just say, now do it. It has to be when you're ready. And they would sit down in a comfortable, safe place. The safety was important. And then they'd close their eyes, and then they'd imagine a heart in their chest. And it was a Valentine's Day heart, not a real heart. If you've seen real hearts in medical books, they're not beautiful at all. Got tubes all over the place. But the Valentine's Day heart, as everyone knows, imagine a Valentine's heart in the center of your chest with two big doors. The two doors open out. And the nice part of you, the part of you which you can respect and love and live with happily, all the nice times you remember, the joyful times of people who care for you and love you and the wonderful experiences you've had in your life, all those little beings which bear your name at different ages, that's inside. That's a you you can very easily live with. But then what happens next is you look outside. Outside of your own heart is these little beings you were in the past, young girls, young boys, who were treated just so painfully. The physical abuse is only a fraction of it. The emotional, why? That just makes it just so hard to bear. You kept all those beings outside of your own heart. And they were you. And so, imagine a ladder coming from your heart, going down to the ground, and seeing all these people who were you. And you're inviting them up. I won't judge who you are, what happened to you. No matter who you are, come in. And to do that is just one of the most courageous things you could do. right, those little beings who you're trying to just forget, trying to ignore, trying to cover up, trying to get out of here, get away, you know, you don't belong with me, you were just so painful. You allow them all to come up, one by one. So little beings have been alone and separated out of your heart for so many years. And you embrace them. And they're in your heart now, not out. That's a huge change. And they said that worked amazingly. And some of those women who've gone through that would come here on a Friday night. I remember speaking to them, seeing them, and it just blew my mind. And they told me what they've been through, and you look at them now, and wow! They were just some of the amazing heroes, so strong, they were like saints. I said, that's who I am. And they don't traumatize themselves with that anymore. That's an extreme. I mean, we've all been through some pain and difficulty in our life. There's things we'd rather forget. Why don't we invite that in instead? Embrace that, that's who you are. It's your life. And something happens. What happens? I'm going to keep on telling the same old stories, but they're powerful. What happens is the old story of the monster in the emperor's palace. Monster came in the emperor's palace, get out, you don't belong. Who do you think you are coming in here? And the empress, she was wise, because she was also a member of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. She would come every Friday night. So, when she went back to the palace, she saw this big monster in there, really ugly, really frightening. What she said to the monster was, welcome. Thank you for visiting. Has anyone got you anything to drink here, anything to eat? What can we do for you? She learned such kindness to monsters. And what happened? This is based on a Buddhist story. Every thought, deed, act of kindness, and the monster grew an inch smaller, inch kinder, a little bit more civil. And they kept on with the kindness so much, this is the shortened version of the story, that soon the monster, who was so ugly and big and frightening and violent, soon became so small that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. And when that's in the Buddhist suttas, that the Buddha said that we call that anger-eating monsters. The more anger you give it, the more negativity you give it, the bigger it gets. There's so much of that in our world. But here I'm just saying in you, get out of here, bad memory, you don't belong. And the bad memory gets worse. It takes a lot of guts and training, but if you do the kindness, welcome. Welcome, bad memory. Thank you for coming to visit me. Give kindness to it. Kindness to yourself. Because so many times when you have a memory which is embarrassing, maybe you're ashamed of, when you actually feel about it, it's a human being, you make mistakes. Please be kind to yourself. Forgive yourself. Care for yourself. Other people who have hurt you, I don't know why they hurt you. You don't know why they hurt you. Maybe they thought they were doing the best thing for you, I don't know. Maybe they had other sort of things they were thinking about at the time, or then maybe they were drunk or they were in drugs or whatever. Sometimes if you can somehow put yourself in their position a little bit, why do they do that? What was their cultural training? Why? If you give kindness to people who've hurt you, it means you're not so vindictive. There's no wanting to sort of harm them back or wanting to harm yourself. So when you give kindness to the negative things of your past, you find all those psychosis, traumas, the bad memories, the stuff which you can't get out of your head, stop you sleeping, stop you enjoying your life because you keep remembering all these bad things. You know, after a while, they get so soft, so peaceful, you can let them go. It's weird. But you overcome negativity with kindness. This amazing, beautiful ability of each one of you to be soft and gentle. And if you're soft and gentle to your past, the negativity of the past can't stand it. It vanishes. So when we do mindfulness, we don't just be aware of the stuff. We know the strategies. If you get a bad feeling from the past, you can, first of all, you say, okay, just I'll let that go because I'm not ready for it yet. But there comes a time when you are ready for it, have all these strategies on how to deal with it. Like another strategy how you deal with some of the negativity of the past. You know, every bad feeling you have in your head, in your mind, has a corresponding feeling in your body, a physical feeling. I already mentioned that at the beginning with the when you're mindfulness of the body and relaxing, the body was talking about like the head. If you are negative, you can read it on a person's face. There's muscles tighten up, there's other muscles loosen up. And that's actually pretty much universal. Even on indigenous tribes, you know, in the middle of the Amazon somewhere, you can still read their emotions on their facial features. So, all of those negative emotions from the past, or fears of the future, that's also written on your body somewhere. And that's one of the reasons why, if you do have some anxiety or fear or whatever by doing some meditation practice, it's not that hard to overcome that. And it just amazes you how easy it is and how effective it is. And of course, the one I'm going to bring up now was, she's not here this evening, thank goodness, otherwise people get embarrassed. But this was a lady who had very bad anxiety. So much anxiety she couldn't get out of bed, afraid even to go through the door out into the world. And she was in Adelaide, a university student. And being in university, she had free medical care, great psychologists, psychiatrists, every possibility, drugs and stuff, nothing worked. So she was like bedbound anxiety, which no one could cure. But fortunately, her uncle comes here. So uncle said, go and ring up Ajahn Brahm. I remember she called me up and she told me what was happening with her. And that's where mindfulness practice, but not just mindfulness. I said, that's not enough. But first of all, I said, when you have an anxiety attack, a panic attack, you know, you're bedridden, where on your body do you feel it? I wasn't asking about her mind, her emotions, because that was just too strong for her to really get to know. Where do you feel it on your body? He said, in my chest. So not good enough. I want to know exactly where. You know, she was studying dentistry, so part of science. I want coordinates. From your navel, your belly button, I want centimeters, millimeters even, to the center of the feeling in your chest. And how far does it extend? Is it a circular, or is it ovular, or is it a square? I want you to describe it to me accurately, with dimensions. Is it more to the left, more to the right, or really central? And give me a call in 3 days. I mentioned that because I wasn't just, well, part of it was I was very busy. I've got to be honest. But it's also, I just wanted her to do something. You know, one of the terrible things if you're in trouble with, you know, either bad feelings in meditation or other stuff, that when people tell you what to do, they're taking away that your almost like your sense of being an owner of your problem and your body. You give up ownership of the disease or the problem to some expert. I didn't want that to happen. So this is your body, it's your emotions. So you tell me, I'm not going to control you. So after 3 days, she called, and I was really amazed at the description she gave. And I said, well, exactly, that's where it is. How does it feel? Is it burning or is it aching? Does it change? Is it the same all over, whatever? So, well, I don't know. Give me a call in 3 days. Which he did. He gave another really amazing explanation of what it feels like. Sensations in the body when you have a panic attack. Great. I said, now, see, that's making her mindful. That's just the awareness part of it. And a lot of times that's all people do when they practice mindfulness. They get to know these things, but no more. And then the extra part, which is the important part, was to say, well, now you know when you have a panic attack, where it is, what it feels like. Now I said, I want you to get your hand, when you have a, she's in bed, get your hand and massage that area with your hand as kindly as you possibly can, with as much compassion and gentleness as you possibly can. And I said to her, if you can't do it, ask your boyfriend to do it for you. I said, I don't think he'd mind. And give me a call in 3 days. And she did that. That was beautiful, because this is one of those times again which just really makes me just feel, you know, wonderful how meditation works. And I asked her, did you follow my instructions? She said, yeah. I said, what happened when you massaged the panic attacks in your chest? She said, well, I massaged them and massaged and massaged them. And then the feeling in the chest sort of got loosened and relaxed, and eventually the feeling in the chest went away. And I said, well, when the feeling in the chest went away, what happened to the anxiety, to the panic? And that's one of those beautiful moments when she paused. It's when the light bulbs went on, when the eureka moment happened. I said, well, when the physical feeling vanished, so did the anxiety. Now you know how to overcome your anxiety. Deal with the physical manifestation, the physical counterpart. Once that disappears, also the emotional, the inside part also turns off and vanishes. That is wonderful, lovely lady. She, I think it was 2 weeks, and she was back in classes again, out of bed, and graduated with first class honors in dentistry. And then just her boyfriend she married. And one of the nice things, people think that Ajahn Bob's not a romantic. But they got married in the Sunken Gardens in UWA. And who do you think gave the blessing there? they had to have me go there. I didn't find it out until later on. Now, she was so impressed that she even actually nominated me for Australian of the Year. I didn't get it, but I can understand. She was just, wow, this really works. But this is actually just an example of how we deal with negativity. It's not just a mindfulness, not being aware of it. She was totally aware of it. But also what to do with it when it comes up. Give it compassion and kindness. The right motivation in Buddhism is you're just letting go, being kind, being gentle. And if you do your mindfulness practice with those things in mind, you will find that when something comes up, which is a bit negative, some bad memory from the past has come up, and you can actually be soft with it and kind with it, and it just melts it all away. So that's something which we can do, and it's powerful stuff as well. You know, those little stories which I mentioned there, they're real stories, and it happens. And my own little stories, you know, every time if I have sicknesses and stuff, it's not just emotional problems, physical problems. I keep telling the monks that, you know, it's my 70th year on planet Earth now. In August I'll be 70. So I kept on telling them, said, monks, I'm getting old. And they said, no, you're not getting old. And I thought they would say that because of kindness. They said, no, no, we're not saying that out of kindness to you. We're saying that out of truth. You are old. You're not getting old. You've already arrived. But I don't know where I was going with this one. But anyway. So many times in my life, you have sicknesses. And some of those sicknesses which I've had, you try and take medicines and stuff, and quite honestly, these days I much prefer doing kindness to any sicknesses which I have, awareness and kindness. You're looking at my body, where's the problem? Well, it's there. You may have, like, the time which I had food poisoning. Real food poisoning. In my, where was it? In my cave. I was screaming. No one could hear me. Because these were like cramps, which food poisoning gives you. Ah! And then it just disappeared. Ah! Totally involuntary. I couldn't do anything with it. And then I knew no one could hear me, because that's the point of having a cave. Two doors, it's underground. It's, well, I can't hear what's going on outside, which is wonderful, but they can't hear what's going on inside, which is a difficulty sometimes. So anyway, I did my same as I teach other people. Sit there, being mindful and being kind. Well, those two are very, very, very powerful. I think the last talk I gave here about opening the lotus, wasn't it? Remember, that's the sun has light and warmth. That's what opens lotuses up, the light and warmth of the sun. Light stands for mindfulness, the warmth stands for kindness. Those two go together. And they're incredibly powerful. They're just kind to the cramps in your tummy. So kind to them that every time they repeated, ah, 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 maybe two or three minutes before you had a cramp. But every time that the cramp got less. My awareness was sharp enough that you could feel it just less painful, because I was kind to it. Next one was less painful, next time was less painful, next time was less painful. Only a tiny bit less painful, but I could perceive that because I was aware. I wasn't trying to think, oh, I'm going to die, what should I do? But I was being aware of it, and then it got so soft that after 30, 40 minutes it just vanished completely. And that was weird. Even I was really struck by that. It's usually food poisoning, you just got to go to a doctor, and I don't know what you've got to do, but this is much better than going to a doctor. And then just afterwards meditating nice and peacefully. And never came back again. It's weird, but it's so true. I'm sure many of you may have had examples like that. So the mindfulness with the kindness, put those two together, it is really powerful. And not just powerful, you find your awareness gets stronger. That's the part which most mindfulness teachings, the worldly stuff, they don't really mention that. That's where your mindfulness awareness gets really so strong. I have to invent words for this because no one else does. Like powerful mindfulness and superpower mindfulness and mega power mindfulness. That's what it feels like. I do not take drugs. Sometimes people, what drug are you on, Ajahn Brahm, today? Because you're so happy and joyful and healthy. And what's going on? This is the natural, you're empowering your awareness. And your awareness, after a while, gets so incredibly strong. That's when, if any of you like food, I don't know about you, are you going out for a meal after the talk tonight? Maybe you didn't have a meal before. Or if you really want to enjoy food, meditate here first of all, and then go out. And you will find You don't have to spend a lot of money on an expensive restaurant. Just go around the corner to McDonald's. And you just bite into that, whatever you're biting into, and it'll taste out of this world. It's nothing to do with the hamburger or whatever else you're eating, but everything to do with your mindfulness being so strong, so powerful, that hamburger tastes like it's been made in a six-star restaurant. It's not what's in what you're seeing. It's not what's in what you're eating. It's everything what's in your mind. Your mind is clear, sensitive. And if you hear any music, wow, it thrills you, because you're picking up everything which is being there in the sound. And this is what happens, this is life as a monk. I love this, you have so much joy. At night time right now, and serpentine, you look at the stars in the evening, they're absolutely thrilling, they're gorgeous. You just look up and you just can't take your eyes away. The dawns, it makes you just amazing. Who wants a TV? Who wants anything? Just if you want to watch something, who wants to go to a museum? When that's happening right there, it's for free. And so much of the world of life becomes so sensitive and so amazing, it's so beautiful. You get a huge amount of happiness and joy when your mindfulness gets really strong. And even sometimes you meditate, you look at the carpet. Have you ever noticed how beautiful that carpet is? Am I going crazy? The point is that when your mindfulness gets strong, every shade of those light blues and dark blues and reds and yellows and whites, and the way that they interact together, and the texture of that carpet, it just really comes out and blows your mind. It becomes beautiful. Free happiness in the ordinary. And if that carpet looks beautiful, you look at your old grandma, she's gorgeous. And I'm not joking, that's what happens. Superpower mindfulness, and you see beauty in so many things, in your past, in your future, in your people you live with, in your children, in your partners, in your grandparents, in your monks, in your nuns, in your politicians, in the police who stop you. You know, sometimes I just wonder that people like being around monks. That's what you do anyway, because you come every Friday night. But why? I always remember that one politician, apparently she's still in politics, that's Alana McTiernan. Years and years, about 30 years ago or something, she was in politics, and we went to go and see her for something. And afterwards, after we talked to her about something, she had some really wonderful advice, and she got off her seat, and instead of letting her secretary take us to the door, she escorted us to the door with kindness, and she said, I really enjoy people like you coming to my office. And she meant it with sincerity. And I always wonder, why did she say that? It's just because, the monks and nuns are kind. We generally have something to complain about, but we don't do it. Hey, you should do this. Why are you doing that? We pay you with backs. No, just you could feel the kindness there. The gentleness, the beauty, the peace. So that's what happens when you're mindful and kind. You make friends in the weirdest of places. So anyway, that's the talk for this evening. The mindfulness by itself, I agree, can have some problems. But you add the kindness, you add the rest of the factors, like we're doing this not to get things, but to let go of things. We're doing this out of kindness and gentleness. If that motivates your life, wow. Meditation is so beautiful. Thank you for listening. I always say when people try and do something and they don't do it properly, if you're going to clap, clap. Scream, I don't know about screaming, but anyway. Thank you. First of all, any questions from the people here? Yeah. Nice, no.
Ajahn, how do we apply loving kindness in a, say, not-for-profit organization?
Yeah. Again, look, Buddhism is one of the few non-profit religions because we don't believe in prophets. You know, Jesus was a prophet, other people are prophets, but we don't have prophets in Buddhism. We're really non. Okay, it's an old bad joke, but never mind. How to have loving kindness? I think because I have met many millionaires in my life, and just when I was at a state dinner once over in Canberra, I went to the toilet. I know in male toilets, you know, for urinals, you just have them one next to the other. And so I went in there, and the fellow who was in the next urinal to me was, yeah, that's right, Lachlan Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch's son, Lachlan Murdoch. And as soon as I saw his badge, Lachlan Murdoch, I thought, if only I had a donation envelope. But one of the people I just think I quoted recently, he was the head of the Changi Airport Corporation many years ago. And it was just the day before he was opening Terminal 4 in Singapore. And he was next to the head of Keppel Shipping, who was the highest paid CEO in Singapore. So these were Buddhists. And they said, how do you do loving kindness and put Buddhism into your business? And I remember the head of Changi Airport Corporation, he said, people go to work every morning and they expect to be happy. But how many of you go to work in the morning with the resolution to make someone else happy today? So that's why you don't feel any happiness. You expect someone else to make you happy, but you don't go to work with the main desire of, I'm going to make someone happy today. So just changing a person's attitude a little bit. I don't know where you work. I work in BSWA. So I often go to work on a Friday night. I'm going to make somebody happy tonight. So you put happiness in there instead of expecting happiness to be given to you. You become proactive. So that's one way in any organization you can actually put some joy and happiness in there. It's wonderful when that happens. Human beings are just gorgeous people. And they just need to touch that goodness. I just remember because I don't know why I got involved in Curtin University of all places, but I was given the John Curtin Medal there once, and so I often go there for one reason or another. But it happened over here. There was a Sri Lankan woman, and she would come here not that often because she was very busy looking after two children, and her husband was actually working two jobs to get enough money because the wife was actually doing a training in nursing at Curtin University. And unfortunately, that one night, double job, not enough sleep, he crashed the car and killed himself. And it was a tragedy. He was trying to work too hard. And the wife, with two kids, no way she could pay the tuition fees at Curtin. So I got on the phone to the the Vice Chancellor, Jeanette Hackett. She became a good friend. I confess this, that on one occasion she was just retiring. "Ajahn Brahm, I just love my association with you," she said. She said, "I'm going to give you a hug." You're not supposed to do that to a Buddhist monk. But she was too fast for me. It was only once. But anyway, I called her up and said, "Look, this is real tragedy." She said, "Yeah, what is it?" And because they know you, you can actually get straight through to them. And said, "Look, any chance of getting a scholarship for her?" She said, "Oh, leave it with me," she said. And of course, they got the scholarship for her. And so everything paid in Curtin University. And just, I think the locals over here, we try to help her with some donations for her costs of living and stuff. And eventually, when she graduated as a nurse from here, she came up, just came up and said, "Thank you." And basically saved her life. Unfortunately, couldn't save her husband's life, but at least could save her. So, you know, these people you may think, oh, they're just big bosses somewhere. They like doing good things as well, kind things. They don't like being exploited. But you give them an opportunity to do something good, and they will run for it. Anyway, what a good people I've seen in life. You know, give them an opportunity, and they love doing great stuff. Okay, here we go. From Hong Kong. I'm very sensitive to smell. Halfway through the meditation, I smell cigarette smoke and drain smells. Is it desirable for me to deal with them, e.g. close windows halfway through? Sometimes that's why people used to light incense in temples. Because when hygiene wasn't that good, you do smell the incense. I don't know where, you know, it's your Hong Kong. Halfway through meditation, I smell cigarette smoke. You know, sometimes you can turn the sense of smell off. In other words, you're just going inside the body, and the joy of peace is so strong that you don't hear things. You can't be disturbed by something like smell. So if you go deeper quickly, then you won't so smell anything at all. And I don't know where you're meditating. If those cigarette smoke and drain smells are there anyway, just try and meditate somewhere else which hasn't got those smells. Is it desire for me to deal with them, close windows halfway through? No, close the windows before you start. And then you won't have those cigarette smoke and drain smells. From Poland. When we meet a person who is saying or doing awful things to us, how we can still be kind to that person when they continue to be in our life and do us harm? If they're saying things, and then are they really doing you harm? This is one of the reasons why that when I complained to my teacher Ajahn Chah about the mosquitoes, said they were really doing us harm. You know, biting us all over the place, and who knows that. You know, say they don't have malaria, just need one, just one, and that's it. But anyway, so when I asked Ajahn Chah, can we have some mosquito repellents, or, you know, some coils, or some protection like mosquito nets, he said no. That's how kind he was. But then what he really meant was he said, no, from now on, he said, you'll call the mosquitoes your teacher, Ajahn Mosquito. That was hard, but it was beautiful. You learned so much from that. So, you meet a person who's saying and doing awful things to us. See if you can protect yourself, however much you can. And if also be kind. If it's too difficult to be kind to them, there's an old saying in Chinese, to love the tiger, but at a distance. So you can move away from them a little bit. If they are doing awful things to you, again, sometimes you have to call the police. If they're really doing you physical harm. But sometimes, if not, okay, here's another story. This is after about being here about 9 or 10 years. I've been here now 37 years or 38 years in Australia, in Perth. But anyway, this woman came to see me once, and just after one of the talks, just before this hall was made, we had our talks in the community hall, and she came and said, "I've just come to thank you for saving my marriage." And I asked her, what have we done? And she told her story. And this is not an example to be followed, but this was the days when there was very little support for women suffering domestic violence. And she said her husband was being violent to her regularly. And she said she came to this place not to learn Buddhism, but at least when she was here, she felt safe. A couple of hours when she wasn't being hit. That was really extreme. I never knew anything about that, but she said she kept on coming here and she learned the kindness and just focusing on the positive, the watering the weeds and not the... no, I got that wrong, didn't I? Yeah. Watering the flowers, not the weeds. And she said she practiced that, it took her 7 years. And she said, and then you got these little meditation stools, you can see them in the back over there. She said, "You see this meditation stool?" She said, "He made this for me today. That's why I need to come and thank you." He said, "If he made something like this 4 years ago, it'd be to hit me with." And it was really gross, but then I saw her. She was just this really beautiful woman. You know, not just like a supermodel, but just her eyes and her goodness. She was again like a saint. And she said, "Now my husband's totally changed. He's kind to me because what she did every time, you know, he said something abusive or did something abusive, she totally ignored that. How she could do that? Immense endurance. But every time he did something good and kind and wonderful, she really let him know he was appreciated. The extra hug, the extra kisses, oh, thank you so much." She really reinforced the positive behavior in her own husband. And then she showed, he's in the back here, she said, "Over there, that's him." And two lovely children. She earned those. You shouldn't have to earn, you know, your happiness in life. But I don't know why she married that man, but she totally changed him. He came down to the monastery as well, wonderful guy. So it's possible. But you know, that's going a bit far because that was physical abuse. But she did it, good on her. From Bangalore, "Respected Ajahn, how does one investigate the I or me who is meditating, watches feelings, thoughts, breath, etc.? It seems to be perceivable as long as there's something to perceive." You don't go thinking and trying to perceive these deep teachings. You let these deep teachings come to you. So in other words, things start to disappear. You relax to the max. You don't try and contemplate things. You see things. That's how this works. And how it works, many have heard this simile before, I'm going way over time again, the old tadpole and the frog simile. Tadpole can't understand water, can contemplate water, think about water, investigate water. Tadpole will never know what water is, no more than a fish can know what water is. But the reason I said tadpole instead of fish, because one day tadpole goes into frog, and frog goes arms and legs, and frog doesn't know what they're doing, and they jump out of the water one day. Now when water has vanished, now the frog can understand what water was. The same way, we go so deep in meditation that soon, you know, we don't have our body, we don't have our mind, have nothing left. Now you understand what you thought you were. You don't do this with philosophy. Philosophy gives you, please excuse me, gives you headaches. But seeing gives you truth. From Melbourne, "Dear Ajahn, when worldly pleasures disappear, there's sadness. But when happiness experienced with deep meditation disappears, no such sadness can be felt. This is correct? The deep meditation disappears, no such sadness can be felt? No, because it's a happiness of contentment. Contentment means you're happy no matter what. It's contentment of having no desires, the freedom from wanting. When you don't want anything, then suffering starts to vanish. From Indiana, the Edgebomb, I lost my 15-year-old to suicide in December. What would the Buddha say to do to lessen this kind of suffering? Just to understand that your son will come back again. Suffering is not the end of all life. Sorry, no, that's the wrong answer. I'm getting tired. Suicide is not the end of all life. Many times people commit suicide, they come back again pretty quickly. So the person made a mistake, big mistake. So next time they can come back. And if life is more meaningful, then who would ever want to commit suicide? And I remember just when I was in Singapore, there was one kid just jumped off the balcony of one of these big apartment blocks, killed himself. But the suicide note was in the front page of the Straits Times, and it was just war. It made many people wake up. It said, all I wanted was more time with my parents. And of course you can understand what that means. Many times the parents are working so hard because they want to get the best education, the best this, the best that for their kids. All the kids really wanted was just time. If they had a father like my father, who just spent so much time with us, he wasn't wealthy at all, he was really poor, but gave me so much inspiration. That's what children want, they want time with the people they love. Lastly, another one from India. Which is better to meditate, a place with noise and comfort for meditation, or a place of seclusion with difficult conditions? Ah, the best of those is a place with comfort and seclusion. In other words, you just change the things. Noise and comfort for meditation, or a place of seclusion with difficult. If it's noise, it's very easy to stop noise these days. Get noise cancelling headphones. Can you do that? The most important thing with whatever you experience, comfort, noise, difficult conditions. I've meditated so much, really, places you should never be able to meditate in. Sometimes I do that to test myself. You know, just, I mentioned, I think, last time in Suvarnabhumi Airport, you know, right in the place, you know, where people are welcoming the visitors. Hi, hello, nice to see you. How you been? Why are you waiting so long? Just right there, just sat down, closed my eyes and meditated for an hour. Very beautiful meditation. Or uncomfortable, in Hay Street Mall. Years ago, there was, might as well mention this. Even years ago, the Burmese community were doing a little, bring people's attention to the troubles in that land. It's happening all over again now. But that time, they invited me just outside of, what was it called, that church there? One of those churches there to meditate for 2 hours. And that was on the hard pavement. No cushions. And right opposite, I think it was called Time Zone? Time, whatever it is. There's a big noise, like where people play video games. And big noise just blasting out. And traffic going past. Now, this is really cool. I like challenging. So I had a lovely meditation for 2 hours. It can be done. But it's better to find a nice, quiet place and comfortable place. So I wouldn't go try to meditate outside of or inside of Parliament House, which is sometimes noisy. Or where else is noisy in this world? I don't know anyway. But yeah, it can be done. So learn in the easy places and then you can progress to the hard places if you need to. Thank you again for listening. Sorry for going on a bit long. So now we can bow 3 times to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then those of you who still want to carry on, you can ask more questions in a few moments. And again, my apologies for not being able to speak to you before the talk. We were having an important little committee meeting. So sometimes we have to look after the The Buddhist Society of West Australia's administration. So sorry about that. Doesn't usually happen. Oops, I'm stuck.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅgho Sāṅgāṁ Namāmi